Blog Talk Radio.
From Dog Works Training Centers, professional canine training centers in Denver, Colorado, and Anchorage, Alaska, this is Dog Works Radio, committed to families and their dogs to build lifelong and fulfilling relationships. Visit our website at dogworksradio.com. Dog Works Radio is part of Twine Group Media and syndicated worldwide on blogtalkradio.com. Now, here are your hosts, Robert and Michelle Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Dog Works Radio. I am hosting from up here in Willow, Alaska, and on the other line, hosting from Denver, Colorado, our co-host, Michelle, how are you?
I'm doing wonderful.
What is going on at Denver Dog Works?
Well, at Denver Dog Works, we just began a wonderful program that I have been trying to put together for a couple of years and just never had enough interest in anyone outside of Denver Dog Works to do it. I am working with the Colorado Community Church here in Denver. They are a ministry church. In other words, they do volunteer projects around the city to help out less fortunate people. And they contacted me and asked me if I could help train some of their ministries participants to become a therapy team group so that when they visit their patrons or people in need, that they already have that group available to provide that service. So we began that this week. I am very excited about it. We had a little bit less of a turnout than we expected, but 10 people is always a good start. The dogs are wonderful. They all passed my temperament test, with the exceptions of one. And the person was just not sure that they wanted to continue with the group anyhow. But when you get involved in therapy, a lot of things are involved in that that have nothing to do with the dog. You have to be ready and willing to give part of yourself to the person that you're visiting as well. And that's what makes becoming a pet partner, if you will, a therapy team person, so rewarding, because it's not just the dog that's able to help that person out. It is you as well.
Well, it sounds like a great program. You said you had 10 people already signed up. And what is it, a group type setting or what?
It is a group training setting. It's based on Canine Good Citizen with a few other disciplines that help people train their dogs how to properly visit someone, visit hugs, and then we added in shake hands just for fun, because we're going to be dealing with people of varying ages and abilities, and you know, we've got some children that are involved that will be recipients of the therapy program. So we wanted to make sure that the dogs did learn how to do some fun things as well. We're going to incorporate some training when we go into the ministry on how we can teach some of these kids how to properly handle and care for a dog. And the therapy dogs are kind of our example of what not to do. You know, don't tug their ears, don't pull their tails, don't ride on me, those kinds of things. You'd be surprised how many people just never had a dog and they don't know how to teach their children what they're supposed to do with a dog. So, you know, we want to discuss not, like, for instance, I adopted a dog when I was 6 years old that my neighbors up the street, older children, were firing off fireworks in her ear. So we discuss things like that, things that should and should not be done with dogs. And I'm so glad that Debbie is going to be our guest today, because she's with Fearful Dogs. And I think that some of my program that I'm designing for this ministry can help out a lot of people that just don't know what they're supposed to do with the dog and how they can treat them better and not create adverse fears for no reason.
Well, that does sound like a good program. And yes, we are going to talk to Debbie Jacobs, and she runs a website called Fearful Dogs, and we're going to get all into that in just about 2 minutes or so. I know Debbie has been on our show before, and she's anxious to talk about her new book and some new seminars and things like that. But before we do, I want you to tell everybody about your photo shoot with Miss Betty White this past weekend in Denver.
Yes, Oh, I didn't know that you wanted me to discuss that. You know, that was a wonderful day that I will keep in my heart for a very, very long time. We were contacted by a local company, Deja Vu Media Incorporated. Mr. Michael Robert heard about me actually through Colorado Community Church because he goes there, and he called and said, hey, I need somebody with dogs. Can you guys help me out? And they gave him my phone number, so I already had a deep-seated connection, so that meant a lot to me. But we were asked to provide 2 to 5 dogs that would be appropriate in a photo shoot benefiting the Morris Foundation for Canine Cancer Research. And I discovered later that Miss Betty White, who is your spokesperson, would be in Denver to participate in the photo shoot. I kept it as quiet as I possibly could, and so did the clients that I asked to come. Since we did receive special invitation, I did only ask a couple of clients that I knew had open schedules that I could count on, that their dogs would do anything not only for me but for them as well. So Julie Garino with her Australian Shepherd Buck graciously agreed to appear, and they actually, not only do they participate in the Morris Foundation shoot, they also participate in Orvis. Orvis is a fishing and hunting clothier, and they are raising money as well for the Morris Foundation, and Buck got to do a lot of tricks and play with Miss White, so it was a lot of fun. But I also asked Arthur, a West Highland Terrier, to come in. He is a psychiatric service dog for our client Noelle Nail, who has also been a guest on our radio show so graciously to discuss her ability, is what I like to call it, and the need for her to have a psychiatric service dog. So they both graciously came, and we had a wonderful time. I can just tell everyone, Miss White is exactly what you think she is. She is sweet. She is loving. She is very much drawn to the animals, and she will treat you as if she's known you her whole life.
Well, you know, I'm one of Betty White's biggest fans. I'm probably the only 40-year-old in America that still watches reruns of Golden Girls on Lifetime. So that's kind of interesting. 40-year-old male. So I think I'm a little bit different demographic than most people that are watching that show. But Betty White seems like a great lady, and I'm glad you were able to make that connection and spend the day with her. So without further ado, let's bring up Debbie Jacobs, calling in from Vermont this morning. We're spanning 4 time zones here on this show. It's only 10 o'clock in Alaska, and I believe it's right after 2 o'clock in the afternoon in Vermont. Miss Jacobs, how are you today?
I'm good, thanks.
Well, thank you very much for calling in today. I know we've been on the show with you at least twice. We talked one time about fearful dogs, another time about animal hoarding, and I know those are the two topics that you are very passionate about, and you and I have talked many a times over Twitter over the last couple of years, and that's how we made our initial connection, was through social media and Twitter. I tell you what, that's a wonderful tool, not only for dog trainers, but just about everybody, isn't it?
It is. In fact, Robert, it's the fact, your message, Debbie Jacobs at Fearful Dogs, is now trending in Denver.
Oh, that is awesome. Very cool.
I've never trended before.
Well, you know, you got to come up somewhere, so might as well come up in Denver, even though you're in Vermont, huh?
Sure.
So you wrote a book, I believe, since we've talked last, and it's called A Guide to Living With and Training a Fearful Dog. And I know that you've told us stories about, your dogs and how you got involved in this type of training. And you know, being a trainer myself, every one of us has a niche or a specialty that we really thrive in. And you've picked probably one of the most difficult areas to work with dogs and their clients with fearful dogs. It can be so perplexing to deal with this because, number one, they just don't communicate in ways that a lot of people understand. So if you can, Debbie, let's talk about What is a fearful dog? You know, a lot of people think when they think of a fearful dog, it's the dog that's cringing in the corner and shaking, you know, and just has that, humanistic type fear, but that's not always the case, is it?
Right. I mean, fear can look a lot like aggression as well. I mean, that kind of fear is obvious, and the difference that you'll see is that a dog that cowers and shakes generally causes us to feel sorry for them. We say, oh, that poor dog. But a dog can be fearful and behave aggressively. And those kind of dogs don't generally elicit sympathy from us. They often make us feel fearful and afraid and often aggressive in return. And so it can, you know, that can also be a way that we can identify fear in a dog. And we got to remember that in our brains and in a dog's brain, it's the amygdala where fear, anxiety, and aggression are all centered in the amygdala. So fear and aggression, it's very easy to go from one to the other.
Right, and it's very similar with people too. A lot of times when people are quote unquote backed into a corner, we act aggressively too. So it can be explained very, very closely to how we interact with ourselves as well as how dogs are interacting too. When you are dealing with dogs that are fearful, is this something that's usually a traumatic type of event that's occurred? Is it genetics? Can it be a combination of two? What are you seeing when people are calling you up, Debbie, and saying, hey, I think my dog's fearful. This is why, you know, X, whatever it is.
Right. Well, part of it we'll never know because we don't always know the history of a dog. Generally, the dogs that we're seeing are dogs that have been recently adopted or not so recently adopted, but they were older dogs or adult dogs or even young dogs under a year old that are displaying fearful behaviors and or aggression. And it's hard to know whether it comes from a genetic predisposition, which it could be. It's hard to know whether that dog was abused by someone, though it could be. But generally, the most common cause of fear-based behaviors in dogs is the lack of appropriate socialization during the first, 2 to 3 months of their life.
Right, right. And that is so key. It's that stimulus with all types of different surroundings, not only just human stimulus, but different interactions outside of the puppy pen or wherever you're raising those little guys. That can really make or break a dog. And I think we call it the 49th day of learning in our course that we teach to people to become dog trainers. That first few weeks is so crucial to make sure that dog becomes well-adjusted. When you're dealing with adult dogs that you may or may not know a history of, do you think that what I'm getting at, Debbie, is dogs that are going from shelter to shelter? Do you think that is usually the cause because people can't understand why the dog is acting this way, so they just kind of just give up and say, okay, we got to move on to something else?
Well, you certainly will see a lot of rehoming of these dogs or give-ups of these dogs. And until they actually bite someone, they're quite often just put out there for adoption again. And I think that one of the things that really bothers me a lot is that I really respect rescue. I really think the work that people do in rescue is so important, and I've done it myself. But what really is upsetting to me is that people in the general public who are looking for pets are getting dogs, and they do not understand the effort, the energy, the time that they are going to have to put into that particular dog to help it be comfortable in whatever world they're going to put it in. And I think that that's partly, and I think that many people who are involved in rescue don't realize it. I think that a lot of people will say, oh, it just takes time and love, just time and love, and nobody's loved this dog, and this dog just needs somebody to love it. And sure, we all should be loved. And I and that's a big part of it in that I believe that it's the love that keeps us committed to working with the dog. But for many of these dogs, it's not just time and love. It's a lot of work.
You know, that's a great point that you brought up about how people don't understand, and especially in fearful situations with dogs. You touched on it just a second ago where you said that we often enable it a little bit by saying, well, it's okay, you know, it's going to be all right, I know you're afraid, and it ends up exacerbating the problem. And you hear that a lot with rescue dogs. I'll hear it all the time in our training school is, somebody will come in with a dog that needs training, whether it's aggression or fear or just basic obedience, and they'll say, you know what, we rescued him. I just want him to be a dog. I just want him to run free and, you know, do this or that. But most of the time, like you said, people just don't understand. So if we could hit on that a little bit about how people should begin to understand dogs when they do go into that rescue situation and, you know, get them from the shelter or the rescue group or, you know, rehoming them in what area, how should they start to build that relationship? Dogs shouldn't just be allowed to just be, you know, dogs, so to speak. They have to be, they have to be behaved, I guess.
Well, I think of it as a two-pronged approach. And first of all, and I just want to clarify this, because the language that we use to talk about fear is often a little bit muddy, and people misunderstand some of the language that we use. So I first of all, have to just want to be clear and say that if you do not reinforce fear in a dog by doing anything that comforts or makes that dog feel better. If we can lower the anxiety and stress that a dog is feeling, however we can do it, it does not reinforce the fear. We're not saying to the dog, yes, you are right to be afraid. We can very easily substitute toddler for dog when you're in a situation with a dog that's afraid. And we would no more take a little kid who was terrified of the swimming pool and kick them in the deep end and say, look, you have to deal with it. You know, if I let you be afraid of the water, then you're going to think that there's something to be afraid of. It doesn't really matter. First of all, yes, there may be something to be afraid of. And second of all, it doesn't matter. They are afraid. And we have to first accept that. And the first thing I try to get people to do, and you really hit on it when you talked about relationship, is the first thing we need to do is address the emotion. If we can address the emotional response, the behavioral response usually will follow. And it's easy if you think about it, in that if there's something that you're not happy doing or you don't like, the chances are you're not going to do it, or you're not going to want to repeat doing if you're forced to do it again. But if you enjoy it, you're likely to do it. And so if we can change how you feel about things, and that's what we do with dogs, it does, but that's the first approach. And then the other piece of that puzzle is what you're talking about, which is giving the dog skills, teaching them how, giving them the skills to interact in situations, even if that skill is move away from what scares you, which is very important with dogs who have a tendency to be aggressive. Rather than teaching a dog, look, you luring a dog close to things that they're afraid of, let's first of all give that dog the opportunity and the control to say, I think I'd like to move away, because then they're less likely to become aggressive. And if we can prevent fearful dogs from becoming aggressive, then they're more likely to stay in homes, because once that dog goes from being cowering and afraid to being snarling and snapping and biting, that's it, they're done, they're dead.
And I didn't mean to interrupt you there, Debbie, but there's often no tolerance there, especially in large metropolitan areas. If a dog bites somebody, like you said, they get swooped up, taken to the animal control, and often their fate is pretty much in the hands of whatever the statutes say, and that's unfortunate.
Exactly. Even because it's not unusual for somebody to say, well, the dog bit in this circumstances, and I think, well, that was if I was cornered or grabbed, I might have done that as well. And the fact that the dog didn't break the skin or showed a real inhibition in its bite shows that that dog was actually didn't want to bite, but was doing it in self-defense. And but you're right, we don't go through that list. All that gets written down is that the dog has bitten. And so it's really important when you're handling fearful dogs to not go there. And so that's why my recommendation is, first of all, to address, rather than look at the behavior that the dog is displaying and responding just to that, try to imagine, and this is what humans are really good at, aren't we? I mean, we're empathetic, we care. Think about, why is that dog behaving that way? And then try to manage the situation, first of all, so that that dog isn't exposed to the things that they're afraid of. If they're snapping at little kids, well, don't let them be around little kids. Don't let the little kids near them. If they're growling at other dogs, keep other dogs away from them. First of all, manage the dog so that they're not exposed to their triggers and they don't have to behave in a fearful or aggressive way. And then we can start to build up the dog's skills.
Right. We're talking to Debbie Jacobs, the author of A Guide to Living With and Training a Fearful Dog, and you can purchase that book right from her website, fearfuldogs.com. She's all over the place on social media. Just look her up at Fearful Dogs on Twitter, and I'm sure she would be happy to contact you in regards to more information. So, Debbie, I know we jumped right into it with 2 feet, talking about how we deal with fearful dogs, but I would love to have you tell us a little bit about how you got started in this. You know, I know you've touched with us in the past your story with your dog and how you kind of got started. Can you share a little bit with that?
Sure, happy to, of course. I had been involved in rescue and had fostered dogs and had dogs of my own and had done some training. And in November of 2005, I went down to Tylertown, Mississippi, to volunteer at the Humane Society of Louisiana's Camp Katrina, which was their site that was set up to help handle the dogs that were coming in after the hurricanes. And the dog that I saw there that touched me looked like a Border Collie mix, and I have a Border Collie, and of all the other dogs that were there, and there are, of course, fabulous dogs down there, pit bulls and Rotties and hound mix and chows and all kinds of wonderful dogs, but I saw this black and white dog who was brought in after being rescued from a hoarding situation. He had been in a 477-dog hoarding situation in Arkansas, and when I met him, he was sort of cowering in a cage, and for all of the wrong reasons, because he reminded me of my Border Collie, and he sort of, I wasn't thinking, I was feeling for this dog, which isn't always a bad thing. I think it's good that we can feel for animals. I said, send him up to me in Vermont, and I will find him a home, just thinking that with time and love, he would be fine. And I kept asking the people that were working with him. It took about a month before he was sent up to me. I just wanted to make sure he wasn't aggressive. I had fostered a fear-aggressive dog in the past, and I just didn't want to do it again because it was just so time-consuming, and the liability of it is high when you have a dog that is people-aggressive. And I just wasn't ready to do it again. And I was assured that he wasn't aggressive, and he wasn't. And he was sent up to me, and I brought him to my home, and I let him out of the cage, and he ran around the living room, defecating as he ran, absolutely horrified. I just stood there with my jaw dropped watching this poor dog, and then he landed in a corner, and that's where he stayed for weeks, literally in the corner. Mm. He could not get himself out of the corner. And then I realized that I was dealing with a level of disability in a dog that I hadn't really ever confronted before. I had worked with dogs who were shy and dogs that were a little bit fearful, maybe a little bit anxious, dogs who had fears of things. They were afraid of certain things, but you wouldn't have called them generally anxious. They didn't suffer from a generalized anxiety or from many phobias, which Sonny did and still does. So that's how I got started. I had this dog. I knew that I couldn't pass him along to anyone else. I couldn't give him to a shelter and expect someone else out there to take him on. And I, no other rescue group wanted him because they understood, at least the ones I contacted, understood how much work this dog was going to be, and the likelihood of him being successfully rehomed was low. So he was my dog. Still is.
And, you know, that's how a lot of us trainers get started in whatever niche or specialty we're in. We're dealing with a consequence of something that we become attached to. I know Michelle does a lot of service dog work and therapy work. That is her passion. That's what she's attached to. And that's what makes good trainers. It's not just the cookie cutter trainers that teach sit down and stay that are changing dogs' lives. It's the people that are the most passionate about what they're doing, I think, is what makes the dog training industry such a diverse group. We're all, a lot of times people say, why would you want to have another dog trainer on your dog training show when you own your own business? And it's because, people out there, we can learn from everybody, and I love to have folks like you on, Debbie, to talk about your specialty and your niches. But Michelle has a couple of questions, Debbie, if you will. Michelle, yes. Go ahead.
So, Debbie, I have been receiving a lot of phone calls lately from some local rescues and things seeking out our services because Robert is an animal behaviorist in assistance in rehoming is what they call it. And what they're really looking for is for one of us to rehabilitate a dog and prepare it in a short period of time for new adoption. And the biggest thing I run into is trying to explain to the rescues that the dog shouldn't be going from the person's home that it's being taken from into a rescue situation or kennel, and then into a foster home, and then into someone else's home in less than 30 days, and that's what they're doing. And I really am trying to explain to people that dogs need a routine, and they like a routine, and as soon as you move in a healthy environment or the dog is removed from an unhealthy environment and placed into another stressful environment and another stressful environment, and nothing is, oh, you're here forever, I think it accentuates some of these fears that you're discussing. Can you go into that a little bit?
Sure. I think you're right on. First of all, Michelle, I just wanted to say I thought that the stuff you were doing with the mission group with the therapy dogs is fabulous. That's such good work to be doing. One of the things that I will say to people, okay, you want this done in whatever amount of time, I tell you what, you fit into that bathing suit in 3 weeks. You know, you fit into that dress or that pair of pants for whatever in 3 weeks, and then come back and tell me that, you know, how easy it's going to be to change behavior. If we can't even do it, we can't change our behavior in short periods of time for the most part, and that yet we expect it. And that's what really just continuously amazes me, that we have these expectations for this animal that they are going to be better than we are at changing their behavior, at perfecting behavior. This idea that we're going to have these animals who are 100% all the time, and yet we still go and eat cheesecake when we're watching our cholesterol. And yet we have these expectations that we can create flawless behavior in an animal. Not that we shouldn't strive for it, and not that we can't get really darn close. And I really respect people who put the work and the energy into these animals that can just perform incredible tasks. But I think that for pet owners and even trainers and rescuers to think that they can actually put a time limit, their time limit, on another being, to me, is just, I don't know whether it's naive or arrogant or ignorant. I don't know, but I think it's wrong, as obviously is what you're saying. And I think what I tell people is, forget it, you're on scared dog time now.
So if I could follow up with that just a second, Michelle, before you bring up your next point, is how do we teach our clients that? Because we hear it every day, and I'm sure you do too, is I think it's a product of I want it now society. When you tell somebody in a consultation and you say, okay, this is what it's going to take, and we do this every day, is we're breaking down the steps of getting from point A to point B, whatever that is, whether it's aggression or fear or basic obedience or service work or sports or whatever, many people just think, wow, I don't have the time to do this. I don't have all summer to train my dog. I don't have, you know, 15 sessions to work with you guys. I need it done before the in-laws come over for dinner on Sunday. Why do you think people think that? Is it just that I want it now society that we live in?
I wish I knew. I wish I knew. I don't know why. I can only surmise when I behave that way. But I think that we also see it not only in I want it fast, but the inability to be realistic about what these animals need is also there. You know, that I want this dog, but I happen to work 12 hours a day, but I still want a puppy, and I still want it to grow up and have it be a fabulous dog, but no, I can only spend 2 hours a day with it, and it's going to spend the rest of its time in a crate. I told you I was on my crate rant lately, but it has to do with just the how unrealistic we are in regard to these animals, and maybe it's because they are so incredibly adaptable. And maybe not to blame it on the dog and say it's the dog's fault, but because they are so wonderful at it, that they have been so good at adapting to us and doing what we want and learning despite how we train them, not because of how we train them, that we just assume that that's going to be the case with every behavior.
Right, and that's a great point. That's why we have dogs, is the dogs that, you know, the dogs from way back in history, that's how humans became companions to dogs or vice versa, is those dogs that came in to adapt to us. It wasn't the dogs that were hanging out in the, you know, in the shadows. It was the dogs that were coming up to us that eventually developed into the dogs that we have today. And I think a lot of people would really get some insight if they understood some of the evolution of the dog. And I know that's a huge subject, and I don't want to go into it today, but that's why dogs are dogs, is that adaptability, and I think that's a great point. We're talking to Debbie Jacobs, the author of, I closed that site real quick, A Guide to Living with and Training a Fearful Dog. You can find more information about her on her website at fearfuldogs.com. Michelle, you have another question?
Well, I would like to know from Debbie, what is her biggest advice for someone that is looking for a puppy? I have a breed referral service that I offer, and I've offered it for, 20 years. And over the 20 years, I've probably had a handful of people that actually thought ahead of the game, gave us a call and said, can you help me find an appropriate dog for myself or my family? And I'm not really sure what I want, but this is what I like, or this is what I've had in the past, and I'm not sure this is for me now. That percentage of people is so small. I'm wondering, Debbie, how we can educate and advise people that, you know, sometimes wanting that pet right now might not be the best idea, so there could be an alternative, or there could be something else you can do to fill that need for, you know, the puppy medicine, if you will.
Right, right. Oh, I hear you, and I've often thought that what a great business that would be to just be out there being a new pet consultant. It's like you can hire people who will go to somebody to help us find a new car. I mean, there are people who will help you buy a new car, and we'll go to them for that help. But when it comes to a new dog, I think we just, again, think that it's that simple. And I think it used to be. I don't know. Again, the questions are they almost feel like questions of the universe. And I wish I knew the answer. But I have the same questions myself. But what I look for when or what I've seen as far as the dogs that generally are the most tolerant and are the most successful are dogs who seek out the companionship of people. They want to be with you. They want to be with other dogs. Dogs that are either play or food motivated. They're interested in you. I mean, those are these. That's why we want dogs. I think when people are your breed service would be great to know the breeders and what have these breeders done with these puppies, to go to a reputable breeder who can say, you know, yes, this dog has been, it's driven in the car, it's met all the neighborhood kids, we've gone for walks in town, it's been in the kitchen when I grind the coffee, it's heard the TV, we've had thunderstorms or whatever, we've had loud noises, there's been all kinds of objects in the room with them. They've been exposed to this stuff. That's what I would be looking for. And in fact, one of the things I've been thinking about lately, because I have been fostering this dog that was a street dog, and this dog is one of the most incredibly skilled little dogs I have ever met. He's about 5 months old. He spent probably his first few months, he was probably born in somebody's backyard, probably hung out there long enough to get used to people and be happy with people and realize that people were worth being around. But then when he got a little bit older, he and his litter were dumped out in the woods somewhere, where he then had to go and sort of fend for himself. And so this dog has spent his whole life problem solving. He's been able to think. His brain has had the opportunity to develop in the ways that his brain has the potential for. And I think that that's one of the things that I look for is how has this dog had the opportunity to grow and to develop, and not how have they been kept from doing that. So the longer they've spent isolated, the longer they've spent restrained, the longer they've spent away from the company of people or other animals, especially when they're young, the less skilled they're going to be at all of those, at having those skills. So I don't know. There was no short answer for that, but that's sort of where the tangent took me.
You know, that's a great point. A dog with street smarts. I think that helps out a lot with a dog's development. Debbie, let's talk a little bit about types of training and expectations in regards to fearful dogs. You know, a lot of times trainers, typically it's the more novice trainers, the people that are just getting involved in the dog training industry, think that they can train every dog using the exact same principle, whether it be treat training or clicker training or even some adversive type trainings using, you know, training collars or shock collars or whatever people are using in their practice. How do some of those techniques work or not work with dogs that are fearful?
Right. Well, one of the things that I think about when I look at a dog that displays fear or aggression a significant amount of the time, enough so that it is a worry for people, is that their brain has gotten very good at being fearful or aggressive, and that however we handle that dog, we need to avoid giving them any opportunity to be afraid or to behave aggressively. So however we handle them, we need to be careful to not give them that practice. Instead, what we need to do is help them learn how to feel good. And how do we learn how to feel good? We tap into their brain's reward system. If we can grab a dog's the reward system in a dog's brain, we can grab that. We have that dog. We can control that dog. We know how powerful the reward system is in our brains. We know it because we can get too much of a good thing when it's rewarding to us. The beauty of working with a dog and using and taking advantage of their reward system is that they can't become addicted to hot dogs because we control the hot dog. and that they can't open the refrigerator and eat all the ice cream in the freezer because we have the thumbs and we control the rewards, whether it's a hot dog, whether it's play, whether it's, you know, the Frisbee, whether it's opening the door to go outside. If we control the reward, we can control the dog because it is so powerful. So for me, my recommendation is I don't do anything that scares or hurts a fearful dog. It makes absolutely no sense to me to do it. Now, not to say that there aren't going to be people who are out there who'll say, look, I did this and it worked and whatever. I mean, I'm not going to argue with people who tell me, well, you know, I put a choke collar or a shock collar and I made this happen or whatever. Again, I'm not going to argue with people. As I say, dogs can learn despite how we handle them, not because of how we handle them most of the time. But if we look at how brains work and how they change and how behavior modification works and the neurochemistry of the changes in a brain that grabbing a hold of their reward system makes so much sense. And so what I do, whether you're using a clicker trainer, whether you're using food, whether you're using play, you said this earlier, how do we work on that? It's the relationship we have with the dog. And if I can have a relationship with a dog that, first of all, they want to pay attention to me, they're not afraid of me, they're going to learn to trust me, then that is where, that's also my edge in there, that they have a reason to notice me, and that when they start off, I can make it so that as soon as they see me, they feel good. Then I can then work on helping them learn to feel good when they see that stranger walking down the street, or when they see that other dog, or my dog Sonny, when he sees me walk into a room with a coffee cup in my hand and he goes, oh no, you know, something new, a change in my environment. Because we have that relationship. So that is, and that's also why I never want to do anything that scares or hurts a dog, because I don't want to take the risk of damaging my relationship with the dog. Now, that said, once I have a relationship with a dog, and if I need to say to my dog, hey, you know, knock it off, you are not going to take that muffin off the table, thank you very much, we have a solid enough relationship that if I do anything that might happen to scare them, whether I, you know, hopefully if it's unintentional or what, if we have a relationship, a good relationship, that it can tolerate that. It's the difference between meeting somebody for the first time and having them say to you, hi, nice to meet you, gosh, that outfit makes you look fat. And you think, well, thank you very much. Why am I going to want to meet you again or hang out with you if that's the way this relationship is going to go? As opposed to somebody you love and trust who says, hey, you know what? If I were you, I'd probably get changed because that one really doesn't do you justice. That relationship can tolerate that kind of behavior or that kind of relationship or that kind of interaction within the relationship. But if you don't know that you have that relationship with a dog, I don't risk it. I don't risk it for a minute. When I meet a new dog, it's up to them to let me know, yes, Debbie, we now have the kind of relationship where if you did trip and fall in the room or you did happen to reach out and touch me, I might spook, I might startle, but I'm not going to then run away from you and not come back for 2 days. And so I am really careful when I'm handling dogs to just watch and say, you let me know when we have a solid enough relationship for me to take the next step and move up as far as what my expectations are for your abilities.
We're talking to Debbie Jacobs, the author of A Guide to Living With and Training a Fearful Dog. And she has a wonderful website, guys. It's fearfuldogs.com. She has all the things that we've been talking about for the last 45 minutes on there. And I'm trying to touch on a little bit of everything in our hour that we have together. And we could probably talk for several shows about this topic. It's such a wide topic that covers so many dogs. Debbie, if we could, in this next section, let's talk about how a lot of times dog owners have been pigeonholed into particular types of behavior definitions. You will often hear people coming into our training school that have been told by other trainers, hey, your dog is people aggressive or food aggressive or dog aggressive or whatever they are. And all of a sudden, everything that they're dealing with their dog and their relationship is based on that diagnosis.
Right.
How do you deal with that when you're dealing with people that are coming to talk to you, whether it's about fear or anything else?
Right. Well, the most common ones I hear are the dog is either stupid, stubborn, or dominant.
Yeah.
And generally, when I hear that, I think, you know, maybe the dog is stupid, maybe the dog is stubborn, maybe the dog is behaving in a dominant way in a particular situation, but there's a good chance that they're not. And I then have to just look and say, first of all, the dog isn't being stubborn. The dog maybe doesn't understand what you're asking them to do, which is often the problem. The same with the dog being stupid. When I've had somebody tell me that they thought their dog was stupid because their dog was afraid to do something. And I wanted to say, sit down and play this piano. And they, well, I don't know how to play the piano. Well, then you're stupid. No, you're not stupid. You don't have the skills in this situation to do what it is being asked of you. And that's what happens to fearful dogs or any dog. You know, in a situation, we often ask them to do something they don't have the skills to do, and we think if we keep repeating it, or we say it louder, or if we give them a pop, or we yell at them, that suddenly they're going to be able to do it. And not to say that there aren't dogs who know what is being asked, and they look at you and go, actually, right now, I'm really much more interested in that squirrel. That's a whole different thing, but we often, you know, again, that's the stupid or the stubborn. And then, of course, the dominant one is just a big problem. I was talking to someone recently, and the dog was being dominant. Oh, and really what it turned out was the dog was being physically reprimanded for behavior that was really just exuberant, rude behavior. It wasn't necessarily bad behavior. It was, we would think of it as bad behavior, but in the dog world, it was just, I'm happy to see you, and yes, I'm going to jump all over you, and I've been left alone all day, and so I'm so happy to see you that I am over-the-top excited. And then the dog was being physically reprimanded, and so when the dog began to respond to being physically reprimanded, now suddenly the dog was behaving aggressively. And I guess you could define it as the dog behaving aggressively, but they were calling the dog aggressive, and that would be like sitting on a subway and having some stranger come and sit next to you, and when they put their hand in your pocket, you slugged them and said, leave me alone, and then having people say, wow, you are really an aggressive person. I mean, it's just that we can be very narrow-minded in thinking about dog behavior, and I think that's what you're getting at, is that we really can just be so limited in what dogs are capable of. And for me, the spectrum, I mean, the kaleidoscope of dog behavior and dog emotion and what they do experience or are capable of is so rich that the proof of it is just in how screwed up they can be. If they were really that simple, if it was really that basic of cookie in, behavior out, or punishment in, behavior out, that it would be easy. But they're not. They're so complicated, and I think that people don't give them that much credit. And yet at the same time, we credit them with being little Zen masters. You know, they live in the moment, and they love unconditionally, and they help lower our blood pressure, and they're going to make us lose weight because we're going to take them for walks every day. I mean, these animals are going to change our lives and save us, and yet at the same time, we don't really acknowledge just how complex they might be.
I think that I think that's a great point. Michelle, you had something to add to that?
I do, and I know it's hard when we're about 6,000 miles apart between the three of us. But I would just like to say something on those points. My clients come to us for various different reasons, and I received recently a very nice compliment from one of my clients. She said that she had been reading some of our reviews, and she said, you know, Michelle, some people just don't get it. You're not here to train their dog. You're here to teach us how to communicate better with our pet. And I think that that comes down to the biggest problem that we have. You know, for whatever, 2,000 years, you know, we have been living with dogs, and they've had to learn how to communicate with us. But none of us have taken the chance to really sit down and learn how to communicate back with them. I mean, sure, we interject a lot of human emotions into it, as Robert likes to call it, and, oh, you know, he really loves eating cheese with me. Well, maybe he doesn't. Maybe he doesn't like cheese at all, but he eats it because he knows it makes you happy. So, I mean, there's just things that we are learning about how to communicate with dogs recently, but, you know, for 2,000 years, we haven't even hit the nail on the head yet as to how we could truly have a conversation with our animals.
Debbie, you care to comment on that?
Well, I've often thought the same thing, that we've lived with dogs for so many years and we are so bad at understanding them. But I also like to think that there are people out there and trainers out there, you know, yourselves included, who are taking the time to understand. It seems like it can be difficult, and yet in some ways it really isn't that difficult. It isn't that difficult to look at an animal who's cowering away and moving away from something to say, that dog isn't comfortable with that. Or to see a dog who leaps in delight. One of my most favorite stories is John Muir's story about Sikkim, about the glacier. Have you read that story?
No, I haven't.
Oh, isn't that the Alaskan glacier, the Sikkim glacier? I could have it wrong, but anyway, it's a if you just Google John Muir and I think it's Stikkim, that's it. And it's this fabulous story, and John Muir calls dogs fellow mortals, and I love it. And he talks about watching this dog show what he understood as just unleashed enthusiasm and relief and delight at having made its way across an ice bridge. And when it got to the other side, it just showed so much exuberance. And John Muir said he understood exactly, and that's when he changed the way he thought about dogs, when he saw that dog respond in a way that he understood, which was relief and happiness and all of those things, which we don't necessarily know scientifically. There are only some emotions that scientists are able to say at this point, yes, we are willing to say that dogs feel these emotions because we can chart it in the brain, and yet there are others that we can't scientifically say yes, they feel this. Like, do we know that dogs do things because they know it makes us happy? I don't know if they do it because they know it makes us happy. They could, but that's really hard to define in the lab, or it's very hard to, we can't ask them. I mean, John Rogerson says this, we have all the theories and the dogs have all the facts. And so we it's hard to pinpoint these things. But I think that in many ways it's not that much of a stretch for us to take emotions that we might be experiencing and say, yes, the dog is also feeling this. I think you're right that we have to be careful. We have to be careful when somebody says he chewed my favorite shoes because he's angry with me for leaving him home alone. I mean, that's when we run into all kinds of trouble with people's relationships with their dogs and the way they respond to their dogs, because, of course, the first thing we have to look at is how a dog's behavior affects us emotionally. If we're not aware of how our emotional response affects our behavior, then we can get into trouble. If I'm working with a dog and that dog scares me or makes me angry, and I will admit it, that sometimes dog's behavior scares me and sometimes it makes me angry. If I am not fully aware that I am experiencing that emotion and how that emotion is going to affect my subsequent response, then I need to move away from that dog. because if I'm angry with a dog for pulling me while they're on a leash, then I shouldn't be holding that leash.
That's a great point, Debbie. And it's all about, like you said over and over, it's all about that observation that we have with our dogs. I think that's the key to the communication barrier that a lot of people have, is they just don't take the time to observe the behaviors that our dogs are exhibiting, good or bad. I think that we can learn a lot just by sitting down and watching how our dogs are interacting. Debbie, we have a few minutes left, and I want to make sure we get this in before we run out of time. Let's talk about your seminars and your workshops. I know you and I talked about this a little bit over email. Let's talk about that for a second.
Great, thank you. Well, I do offer seminars on fearful dogs, and they are dog trainers, CPDTs, can get continuing education units for them, and there's information on the website, and there are a two-part, there is a two-part seminar. There's a one half of it which addresses primarily lecture, which talks about the things that we've been talking about, and looking at fear-based behaviors and how to identify them and how to respond to them and the best ways to work with them. And then another section which deals with specific techniques that I think are the most helpful when working with fear-based behaviors in dogs. And these are techniques which are not necessarily unique to me. I haven't developed them, but that other trainers and behaviorists have identified as providing effective and humane ways for working with fear-based behaviors. So that information is there up on the website. Just another plug that I'll throw out there, another fantastic trainer in Boston that I'm going to be working with in September, that we are offering a weekend in New Hampshire for dog trainers and also dog enthusiasts, but we really wanted to give dog trainers the opportunity to spend the weekend together on an absolutely fabulous piece of property in southern New Hampshire with their dogs and hang out and talk about all this stuff, because this is how I learn, is from batting ideas around with other trainers, and how do you do this, and how do you handle that, and so that's happening in September, and it's called the New England Dog Camp, and that can be found at newenglanddogcamp.com. So that's another thing, and again, I'll be there, and we'll be happy to talk about fear in dogs, and it's another opportunity to talk about dogs and not bore people who don't want to talk about dogs forever to tears, which many of us end up doing when we're at parties, because it's what we love to talk about.
That's the only thing we talk about. I went to a barbecue last night. It was 30 mushers, and pretty much the conversation revolved around us and our dogs and how we get to and fro in Alaska in relation to the dog. So I think that just a regular outsider would not feel very comfortable in that conversation. But Debbie, it's been a pleasure. Again, it's been almost a year since we've had you on, so I appreciate you coming back on, and I'm sure you and I will remain in contact on Twitter, and if something else comes up, I'll definitely shoot it your way. Can you end on some particular point you want to make, just drive home real quick about you or fearful dogs in general, or whatever you want to mention?
Well, first, thanks both to you and Michelle for having me. I really appreciate it. It's great for me to have the opportunity to go on about something that I do feel passionate about. And I guess what I would just leave people with, in any situation you're in with a fearful or anxious dog, do whatever you need to do to lower their stress and anxiety. If you can lower the stress and anxiety that a fearful dog is experiencing, you are taking the first step to helping them improve.
I think that sums it up great. Debbie, it's been a pleasure. We'll definitely keep in touch, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Michelle, anything else you want to mention before we close?
No, I always enjoy having Debbie on, and I enjoy the show. I'm looking forward to possibly preparing an interview for you, for me to interview you, because we have a lot of clients asking about Robert Forto and his mushing adventures, and I think it would be a great show for us to do on Mushu Huskies. I just have to get you talked into it.
Well, you know, it's almost Iditarod time again. Just yesterday they signed up for the 2012 Iditarod at the Iditarod Picnic up here in Wasilla. So we're going to get back into the mushing scene here before too long. I know that we're already starting to train up here in Alaska for next season. Even though it's 100 degrees in Denver, it's only 45 degrees up here in the mornings in Alaska. So we're looking forward to that. Our next show will be next Sunday. I'm not sure exactly what the topic is. We don't have that that website up right now. So without further ado, this is Robert Forto for DogWorks Radio on behalf of Debbie Jacobs of FearfulDogs.com is her website, and Michelle Forto in Denver at Denver DogWorks. Thank you very much, and we'll talk to you guys soon. Goodbye.